Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we hear from farmers about why it's so hard to run a community-supported agriculture program, even in the world's food basket. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Alice Daniel. We look at one Central Valley city that's aggressively tackling illegal marijuana cultivation, especially in rental homes, and the landlords aren't happy. We also visit a medical school that's recruiting residents with the hopes of keeping them in the community.
But first, let's look back at this week's news. Former governors Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jerry Brown were in Clovis yesterday talking about renewable energy and greenhouse gas mitigation goals they set while in office.
And I want to tell you, I don't want to scare you, but we're in big trouble. And if we don't do something, things will get a lot worse. And so you can make the difference. If you can make a robot, you can make a better world.
At Buchanan High School, they emphasized the growing career opportunities in renewable energy and celebrated the construction of 1 million solar roofs in the state, something Schwarzenegger called for back in 2006.
Also this week, the House of Representatives passed the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Among other provisions, the bill would grant legal status to immigrants who've worked at least 6 months in agriculture over the last 2 years through a 5-year renewable visa. The bill is supported by nearly 250 labor unions, including the United Farm Workers.
And the woman who co-founded the organization that would become the UFW, Dolores Huerta, announced this week she's backing Fresno City Councilmember Esmeralda Soria's bid for Congress.
This is like a third world country. Well, you know what? Esmeralda Soria is going to make it a first-rate county here in Fresno County, Madera, Merced counties.
That was Huerta speaking at Arte Americas Tuesday about the three counties that Congressional District 16 represents. Soria is challenging fellow Democrat and incumbent Jim Costa.
On Monday, one of the country's largest blueberry producers and two related companies were ordered to pay $2.5 million in back wages to 3,000 workers by the U.S. Department of Labor. The department says the Munger brothers, a Delano-based grower, along with Crown Cold Storage and Sarbanon Farms, violated the H-2A program and the Migrant and Seasonal Worker Protection Act.
And yesterday, the U.S. Senate unanimously approved a resolution formally acknowledging the mass killings of Armenians by Ottoman Turks a century ago as genocide. The House passed the same resolution in a 405-11 vote in October.
Catch more local news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Physician shortages are expected to get worse over the next decade throughout California, especially in valley towns and rural areas. But in the Inland Empire, where the number of physicians needs to double to meet current needs, one medical school may have an answer. As part of our California Dream collaboration looking at solutions, CalMatters' Elizabeth Aguilera reports from Riverside.
Dr. Mozen Bajwa has been treating Cecilia Jimenez since he was a resident physician in training.
Hi. Hi, Cecilia. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Good to see you.
I know.
It was Dr. Bajwa who discovered a cancerous tumor on her neck and helped her get treatment after years of trying to figure out why she was losing her ability to walk. It's been 5 years, and Bajwa, now an attending physician, is her doctor at the Moreno Valley Community Health Center.
So I wanted to make sure we got the results of the CT scans to go over those together. The good news is that everything looks very stable.
I was like so nervous to hear those results. So scared. But I knew I wanted to hear them from you.
Bajwa is considered a success story in Riverside County's effort to grow, recruit, and retain primary care doctors in the region. It's a huge priority here.
The Inland Empire region has one of the lowest ratios of physicians.
Dr. Jeffrey Leung is the ambulatory medical director for the county's university health system.
And that creates a number of challenges.
Like not being able to find a doctor or waiting a long time for an appointment.
When we have delays in care, that can result in sort of chronic illnesses or acute illnesses that become worse.
Leung helps oversee a residency program here that aims to keep graduates local. Physicians tend to practice where they train or where they are from. Dr. Adolfo Aguilera is the associate director of that residency program.
If they're here to stay, they're going to want to make sure that they are providing the best care that they can, that they are essentially trying to build the program so that we're able to outreach to our community and serve their needs.
A new medical school was opened in 2013 at UC Riverside, specifically to train doctors to serve the local area. The county and medical school have partnered to expand the long-standing residency programs, and medical school students and residents regularly reach out to local middle and high schoolers to get them into the pipeline. Dr. Mozen Bajwa is part of that outreach. He takes residents out once a month to meet with teens in the community. He didn't grow up here, but the program's goals match his, and he has another reason for staying. His wife is from Riverside, and she's also a physician.
The connection with my wife is what brought me out here first, but it was the community and the identity of building something bigger than myself that I fell in love with.
Across California, other initiatives are also aimed at keeping physicians in areas where they are needed. Federal and state programs offer loan repayment to doctors who care for the underserved. For patients, having access to a doctor over the long term that they know and trust pays off.
Every time I come in, it was a different doctor.
Before Dr. Bajwa, Cecilia Jimenez never knew who she was going to see at the clinic.
So it feels good to just come in. He knows what we're going to talk about, you know, not me have to explain to the doctor what I've been through.
At the end of their visit, Bajwa gave her a hug before she walked out.
Many programs talk about serving the underserved, but here the focus that the faculty have on actually taking care of the community and doing outreach in the community is just unparalleled, I think, and that was something that I wanted to be a part of.
Then he was off to a home visit for one of his patients who is now under hospice care. The family promised pupusas if he arrived around lunchtime. From Riverside, I'm Elizabeth Aguilera.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Even as many Valley cities are drafting ordinances related to selling or growing cannabis, few California cities have been as aggressive as Sacramento when going after illegal marijuana cultivation in residential homes. In the last 2 years, the city has issued nearly $100 million in fines against property owners for the illicit grows. But a majority of them claim they're innocent and that their tenants are to blame. Now, dozens are taking their cases to court. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd has this investigation.
I met Hu Yun Lee at his family's rental property in South Sacramento on a recent afternoon. From the outside, it's a small, unassuming home.
If you want to come in, go inside.
Almost everything inside is newly renovated, including the living room, kitchen, and bathroom. That's because his tenant destroyed the place by running a clandestine cannabis grow.
All the ceiling, the sheetrock, the cabinet, everything is damaged.
Lee says he spent about $40,000 on renovations, a lot of money for this working class family. And then came a huge penalty from the city.
We didn't know what to do. The fine was $269,000, and then the house is worth about that much. So basically the city say, hey, we're going to take out your house.
That's because the city of Sacramento holds property owners responsible if a tenant is busted for illegally growing pot. Even if the owner can prove they didn't know about it. Tenants usually get off with little punishment. In this case, the person renting Lee's home walked free. Court records indicate police arrested him at the house, but didn't pursue charges.
He's not even jailed for it. And then we are the one who suffer. We didn't do it, and then we got a fine for it. That's not right. That is totally wrong.
Lee and his mother-in-law, whose name is on the deed, challenged the penalty through the city's appeal process. The family claimed they inspected the house once a year and had a lease that prohibited illegal activity. The city argued the family was negligent in their management of the property and should have known there was a marijuana grow inside. After the appeal, a hearing examiner sided with the city and upheld the fine. Councilman Eric Guerra, whose district has struggled with illegal cannabis grows, defended the city's enforcement approach.
There's a responsibility that landlords have, and if they didn't know that somebody was manipulating the infrastructure of the house, the electrical, they're obviously not paying attention to what's happening with their property.
Lee's family took Sacramento to court over the fine. It's one of more than 40 legal actions property owners have filed against the city for its enforcement program. The case reached a ruling in September. The judge threw out the fine and criticized the city.
The factual findings on which the penalty was based are not supported by the evidence or the law and are irrelevant.
That's Lee's attorney, Alan Donato, reading from the ruling. He claims the fines are more about generating revenue for the city and less about actually stopping illegal cultivation.
And they're going after the deep pockets, the people that are landowners, without any regard to their personal situation or their culpability in the case itself. How does that serve the public interest or the interest of justice?
City spokesperson Tim Swanson declined to comment on the judge clearing the penalty, but noted the ruling commended the city for its efforts to eliminate illegal marijuana grows. Since then, the city has rushed to clear at least 10 penalties with pending court challenges. Some attorneys say it's an effort to avoid more negative rulings. But homeowners in these cases don't walk away unscathed. They have to pay for an attorney, and in many cases an interpreter, out of pocket. Those expenses have set back Lee's family. But in the end, he says they emerged with something invaluable, a renewed faith in government and the legal system.
The law is, what's the word I'm looking for? The law is justified. It is. I feel relief. At least now we believe in the law again.
As other cities look to Sacramento for guidance on their own enforcement programs, they'll also be watching the courts to see what judges decide. In Sacramento, I'm Scott Rodd.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. Many students struggle to transition from high school to college, but that challenge is intensified for students coming out of the foster care system. At UC Merced, the Guardian Scholars Program provides resources for these students that allow them to reach graduation rates approaching the general student body. Moderator Kathleen Schock spoke with Guardian Scholars Program Coordinator Adith Ramirez, as well as two UC Merced students who have benefited from the program's support, Michael Gray and Alyssa Garcia.
So, Michael, I'd like to start with you. Tell us a bit about your background growing up and your experiences that led you to ultimately enroll in UC Merced and become part of the Guardian Scholars Program.
Yeah, so I grew up in the Sacramento area. I was in and out of foster care throughout from like the age of five up until about, I want to say, 9 years old. And so I had been reunited with my parents a few times throughout that time, but ended up in a foster care placement in Richvale. And from there, my grandparents, who were like traveling in Mexico, they actually were contacted, and so they came back to the States and decided to try and get custody of both my sister, my middle sister Kelly, and myself. And so we were in probably, but that was about a year I was already in that foster care system. And so we went through the court system, and then they finally got legal guardianship of me and my sister. And so that was about like fourth grade. And then I was raised in a legal guardianship with them up until like high school. And prior to being raised with them, I hadn't really focused on school or classes or anything like that. My grades were not well at all. They were terrible. But being raised with them, and they had a very strict expectation for us kids. And they knew that we could do well if we were given the chance. And so they instilled that like hardworking ethic in us. And from there, I had picked up. Like, I started excelling from sixth grade on. I had all A's in every class. was valedictorian in eighth grade, and high school came around. I took AP and honors courses as much as I could, and it was like a 4.43. So I knew college was an option at that point, finally. And they had always been encouraging me to go to college from the start because they knew that I could if I put my mind to it. And I chose UC Merced. I had never seen the campus, actually. And I basically initially came here just for the financial aid so I wouldn't have to pay anything and it wasn't a burden on anybody else. But I've come to love the campus. It's nice.
And I do want to hear more about your experience in college in just a minute, but I'd like to give Alyssa a chance to tell us a bit about her story as well. I understand you grew up in or were a part of foster care as well during your childhood.
So I grew up in Fresno, and I was in and out of the system at age six. So I grew up like all areas of Fresno, and I know it really well. I did go to multiple elementary schools and stuff. However, I was still able to maintain like good grades and stuff. So much that I even got to skip seventh grade to actually catch up because I had started school late because of how much moving schools I was and being in the system and not having like a consistent schedule. But I always knew that I wanted to go to college. I do have five siblings, younger siblings. I'm the oldest, so I do hold a big responsibility, you know, to be there for them, to be their role model. And then also for myself, I want to get us out of the cycle. So I knew that pursuing college was definitely an option, and I didn't want to be too far from my, you know, my loved ones. So I knew UC Merced was going to be a good option.
Adith, tell us about the Guardian Scholars program and the kind of resources that this program enables the university to provide students like Alyssa and Michael.
So I'll start off kind of just saying what our mission is. Our mission is to provide a sustainable network of academic and personal support services here at UC Merced that promote a degree attainment for youth who have experienced the foster care system and are homelessness. So we also serve scholars that have experienced homelessness at any point in their life. We strive to create a welcoming and inclusive space through programming and resources designed to help scholars build community, identify their strengths, and utilize their resources. So that is our mission. Some of the services that we provide, so scholars receive priority registration, which means that they get to register for classes before the general population, which essentially guarantees that the scholars will receive all the classes that they want. And it also helps them, like especially if they're working, they're able to kind of work around their schedule. We also work really, really closely with housing to ensure that scholars have a place to stay during gap periods. So that includes winter break, spring break, and summer break. We also provide emergency funds. So say our scholars have an emergency, one of the things that tends to happen a lot is our scholars are not able to pay for rent for a month, for instance. So the program is able to provide scholars with emergency funds to be able to pay for that rent month. We do work with the scholars to come up with a plan about how they will like look for a job or find other resources to be able to pay for the next month's rent. But that is funds that the scholars do not have to pay back to the program. We also provide emergency grocery cards for students, especially during the gap periods. So for instance, we have winter break coming up pretty soon. And during that winter break, some of the dining services on campus are closed. So we do provide grocery cards for our scholars that they are able to use to purchase groceries during that time. We also provide workshops. We do one-on-one mentoring, so all our scholars are required to meet with the program coordinator twice per semester. They also require to see a student coordinator twice per semester. So both Michael and Alyssa also work for the program, and they are two of our student coordinators, and students are required to meet with them twice per semester as well.
So I do want to get into this student coordination piece because I think it's such an important and such a unique part of the work that you're doing at UC Merced. But before we get there, I want to come back to Michael and have you talk a little bit about that transition from high school into college. I mean, that's a really difficult time in any student's life. But particularly given some of the challenges that you experienced or that you see other students, former foster care students experience, it must compound the difficulty.
Yes, it is quite difficult. But kind of like what Alyssa touched upon, there are lots of resources here at UC Merced, including the Guardian Scholars Program. So I originally heard about the Guardian Scholars Program through an email that was sent to me. I never heard of it before, and I was reading into the email a little bit, and it was telling about like the resources that are offered. And I didn't even know there was any resources like this for foster youth in general, across not even just at UC Merced, but across multiple campuses. And so finding out about that also lifted a burden. And so I did all the required paperwork and submitted all of that. And for me, it was also a little challenging with the program, transitioning into the program. And that's because my family actually, right before I started college in that summer of 2017, moved out to Texas. So I went out to Texas with them, and so I wasn't able to go to the orientation of the program and to get to find out more about the program and see more on the lines of the benefits and the resources. But luckily for me, I was able to meet with Adith, the program coordinator, and she was able to get me transitioned into the program specifically pretty easily, and I was able to connect with students pretty right off the bat. And yeah, transition wise, I would say for me it was a little difficult, but having these resources and people like Adith who really care about like this population really make a difference.
And Alyssa, what was your experience?
My transition here was very difficult. As soon as I turned 18, I was automatically an adult, so I had to be like thrown into, okay, you're going to college now, I'm going to drop you off, and you figure it out. So it was really hard navigating school because I just got here, I'm in college, but now what do I do? Where do I go? Where are my resources? What do I do? What am I going to do to help myself? So as soon as I got an email that I could be a part of this program, I reached out as soon as I could. I had a meeting with the Deeds, and I was just like, can you please help me? Like, I have no idea what to do. I'm basically like, I don't have anybody else. And she was like one of the first people to have like a consistent mindset with me and continuously like checking up on me, making sure I had things. At one point I needed to stay for I think a gap period of like the break, and she was able to help me right away. So after that, I knew like this program was really going to benefit me. And if she can help me, then I know all these other students that are going to be part of this population are definitely going to utilize the help.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We're discussing the Guardian Scholars Program at UC Merced, which is coordinated by Adith Ramirez. Adith, tell us a bit about some of the success that you've had with the student population that you serve.
So our program actually has an 80% retention rate in the last 2 years for first-year students. 100% of our scholars also have graduated in the last 2 years for the scholars that were expected to graduate. I think also something that I kind of wanted to add and I guess highlight the scholars that have also graduated recently. So one of our scholars is currently pursuing his master's degree in social work from the University of Southern California. I talked to him recently, and he told me he was actually also considering continuing his education and getting a PhD in social work as well. Another one of our scholars that graduated in May of 2018, she's currently serving in the Peace Corps, and she's in Sierra Leone, West Africa. She currently serves as a community health volunteer, and she's teaching malaria prevention measures. She's teaching how to improve nutrition knowledge and educating the community in healthy water and sanitation. So those are, I guess, some stories of recent graduates. Currently, we have one of our scholars that is studying abroad in Spain. And one of our scholars that is getting ready to graduate is looking into law school and really looking into being able to provide legal services in the future for folks that come from underrepresented backgrounds.
So really extraordinary success that you're having on an individual level. I'm wondering how these retention and graduation rates compare to the general population at UC Merced.
Actually, that is one of our goals for the program, is for our retention rates to at least match the retention rate of the general population. Statistics show that youth that have experienced the foster care system graduate at very low rates. So actually less than like 4% of youth that have experienced the foster care system graduate with a bachelor's degree by the age of 26. So the fact that 80% of our, or, sorry, 100% of our scholars that are expected to graduate are graduating is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And I would imagine part of the success that you've had is your ability to connect students with other students who've gone through similar experiences, which brings us to that, to the student coordinator program. Michael, tell us a little bit about your function and your work as a staff member for Guardian Scholars.
Yes, this is a very unique position, and it's a great opportunity for someone who's been a part of the system and someone who has that insider knowledge and can take what I've learned in my experiences and share it with other students who have gone through a lot of times something similar, but obviously not exactly the same. We all have unique experiences. And with this position has helped me definitely like connect with other scholars, and mentorship is one of my like big things with this role. There are many different pieces to the student coordinator position: mentorship, event planning, workshops. Mentorship is the big one for me, and that is because I get the chance to share what I've gone through, what I've learned from that, and not only stopping with what I've gone through and what I've taken away from that, but how that has moved me to where I am now and pushing me further. And I'm able to encourage other students and be that shining light for them. But also it's different because it's coming from a student, a peer, someone who is at the same level as you. And so you don't feel like I'm trying to be condescending, and they don't feel like I'm trying to talk down to them or just be someone who's like, oh, you should do this, you should do that. No. I share this experience with you. I share a similar experience with you. This is how I've been able to personally grow, and this is how I want to be here for you.
Alyssa, I know that every student that you meet with has an individual story, but I would imagine there is some common ground in experience. And I'm wondering, what is the kind of advice that you provide to students who are maybe in their first semester or just entering into college?
Usually when I meet with my students, this is like really, I feel like this is the foundation to like when you're connecting with them, when you just meet them. And it's that time where you just tell them how like you can relate to them. And I feel like once you start explaining your experiences and saying, you know, I've been through that, I know exactly how you feel. Maybe not right now at that moment, but I have went through that as well. And this is what I did to help me through this way, to help overcome, and I'm going to be here for you. You know, I didn't have somebody to help me, but I want to be that person for you to help you. And I think creating that, once you start stating that and once you start creating that bond, it's not just like not just me saying it, but it's also me showing the students that I care and that I'm just not doing this for work, because it's more than work. I enjoy helping students because I know that I would want to be helped. I know that was me not too long ago, needing resources or having just someone consistently in my life checking up on me.
Adith, I understand this is a relatively new opportunity that you're providing to students. Can you tell us how long you've been doing it, and from your perspective, what kind of results you've seen?
Yeah, so the student coordinators have been around for almost a year now. Last semester, we actually didn't require scholars. Well, they were required to meet with scholars, but it was only once a semester. So this semester, we made the transition into having them meet with scholars twice a semester. And I think just anecdotally, I think that I've seen how it's kind of helped the program build community. And kind of like they touched on already, just like establishing those connections and then them just feeling comfortable or having a safe space to come to and to kind of talk about like whether there be their experiences in the foster care system. But most of the time it's just like being able to connect with someone else is also a student, you know, kind of talk about finals and strategies to study, or just being able to get connected to other resources on campus. But I think there's a sense that like scholars feel more comfortable knowing that someone else has gone to that resource and that they've had a positive experience going to that resource as well. So yeah.
Great. Well, we just have a second before we have to wrap up. Before we do, Alyssa and Michael, I'd love to hear what's coming next for you. What are your plans after college?
So for me, I'm still kind of going around on what I specifically want to do, trying to figure it out. But I do plan on at least seeking higher education regardless. So whether that's a master's program, PhD program, some specialization program, I'm not really sure. I know coming into college, I had really, really been considering maybe med school, and I'm a bio major, so I plan on finishing my bio major. But also by working in the program with this position, I've also been considering either working with this population or doing social work or something along those lines. This position has really encouraged me, and I felt like this is becoming sort of my calling.
And Alyssa?
Yeah, so I am studying psychology, and I do like how, like the route that I'm going. I feel like since this job and having this position, it really helped me grow and see kind of like what Michael was touching on, like what's kind of calling to him. And I feel like I'm able to serve my population that I've also connected with and I have experience. So I feel like what's a better population to work with than my own population. So I might work in trying to get my master's maybe in a social work or some field like that.
Well, thank you all for being with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You are listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Here in one of the world's most productive agricultural belts, we have lots of potential for community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, where consumers connect directly with growers by subscribing to weekly boxes of produce. Last month, however, a prominent Fresno CSA, known as UBI, was the latest of many to shut down. To better understand this trend, FM89's Carrie Klein sat down with three panelists, organic farmers David Obermiller of Fresno and Vernon Peterson of Kingsburg, and Ryan Galt, a professor of human ecology at UC Davis. Peterson began by explaining why he had to fold his CSA, Abundant Harvest Organics, in 2018.
Why did it shut down? Well, a dozen years ago, organic was priced too high. Because it was priced too high, it didn't move, so it wasn't fresh enough. But as time went on, retailers, grocery stores got better. Also, it was hard to find organic. It was hard to find it at a good price. It was hard to find it fresh. So we just came in and we were everybody's hero because we would just roll in with fabulous box of fresh produce. It went very well until, in the free market, the consumer is king. It's a very challenging system, but it's the best system for a society. Mm. And so when we could no longer compete or as our subscriber base dwindled, it just wasn't cost effective to run those trucks. It was a very easy economic situation. Now we're back to farming stone fruit and packing stuff for our neighbors and growing organic chickens and that kind of stuff.
Okay, and so we're here talking about how many very prominent CSAs are shutting down, and Abundant Harvest is one in the last couple of years, but there are a lot of smaller ones still operating in the Valley. David, that includes yours. You're temporarily on hiatus while you move to a new property, but it's been running for a number of years. I mean, what's kind of at the center of your business model?
Well, as far as CSA goes, I like being connected with people in the community. I like that direct connection. I like it as a farmer, but I also like it as a consumer. I like knowing, well, I'm the type of person, I generally shop at the same place. I like to get to know the people that are selling me whatever it is. And I appreciate that, the good customer service, the connection with who I'm supporting locally. And selling direct to the public is really important to us. And CSA happens to be one way that we're able to do that.
Okay, and let's turn to Ryan right now too. So Ryan, you've done quite a bit of research about CSAs in California, the economics, kind of consumer behavior. What do you find is kind of maybe there's not one secret, but are there some secrets to keeping them operating? Is it a matter of business model? Is it a matter of consumer behavior or something else entirely?
Well, it's a really good question, and I think there's a lot to that. One of the pieces that we found early on in the research that I was doing was that the higher the percentage of total farm sales coming through CSA, the lower the salary of farmers. It was a very strong correlation. And so in that was 2013 piece that was published. And with that, I think one of the lessons there was to diversify markets so that farmers weren't dependent fully on a CSA necessarily for their income. So I've heard from some farmers around the state when they diversified markets and they did a little bit better in terms of their own farmer earnings. One thing that we did recently was look at the retention rates of CSAs and try to run some multiple regression analyses to see what variables were most strongly correlated with higher retention rates. And so we found some general lessons for CSA farmers. One is, you know, the more available it is in terms of months per year, the higher retention rates were. If fruit is included from the farm on a regular basis, there was higher retention rates as well. If the farm is following organic practices, that's also a very strongly correlated with retention, higher retention rates. And then crop diversity, too, that was an interesting finding. The more diverse the different types of crop that are being grown on the farm, the higher retention rate as well. So those would be like vegetables, fruits, nuts, pulses, grains, those types of diversity in those big categories. And then one of the findings we noted in this paper also was that the stronger the competition that farmers faced and felt they experienced, that was also negatively associated with retention rates. And that makes sense given, as Vernon was saying before, the high levels of competition that are occurring in many different marketplaces in terms of, you know, regular retailers, grocery stores getting privy to fresh local organic produce and making that available, often for relatively inexpensive amounts of money compared to potentially smaller local growers, depending.
So David and Vernon, does this seem to ring true with kind of your own experiences here with CSAs in this area?
I'd say yes. From our experience, fruit is a big issue. People really, really love having fruit in their box. Competition's an issue. Another issue being variety. And that puts a lot of stress on us as a farm where the consumer goes to a grocery store, and at least in America, you see the same product on the shelf year-round. You know, grapes from America in the summer, grapes from Chile in the winter. And for us as a small farm, to grow 60, 70 different items and provide a virtual supermarket produce department through our farms, a real challenge. One of the things that we heard from our customers was, you know, you provide a selection of produce, but then they still have to go to the store because we don't have bananas per se. And bananas are one of the most popular fruits in the country. Well, the consumer is like, well, I have to go to the supermarket anyway. So now I'm buying from two different people and you got to get online and perhaps place an order. And it becomes a convenience factor too, where we have, I'm American too. I love the convenience of American society, but we're also competing with the convenience factor of the big box store, grocery store.
Oh, it's quite a treadmill to try to do what Tom Willie did, for instance, you know, to have all those items every week.
That's Tom Willie being an organic farmer who had the predecessor to Ubi, this CSA that just shut down.
It's an amazing thing that Tom did. And Tom was a regular provider to our CSA. We would get something from his wife, Dinesh, every week. But we were always fruit centric, so at least a third of the box every week was fruit. Mm. That's what I do. We were able to provide that at a really efficient price point. But yeah.
And so Ryan, you had talked about some regional variations across California and a lot of these different factors. I mean, are there parts of the state where CSAs are doing much better and are able to survive more easily, or is this a problem that if you consider it a problem that CSAs can't survive, or is this an issue that you're seeing elsewhere as well?
Well, yeah, I think within California we see the regional differences that are most pronounced that came out in our data, which is a number of years old now, was really the more rural and more remote counties, the CSAs there were doing better in terms of their farmer satisfaction. The more urban areas were typically lower. And then there was a divide between Northern and Southern California, too, where farmer satisfaction was even lower in Southern California than it was in Northern California. And we see that we did a general survey of the California grocery store purchasing population, mostly everyone. And within that, we did see differences in values of a higher value of organic, valuing of organic in Southern California versus more valuing of local in Northern California, which is pretty interesting. But I think generally, I think there are problems. Certainly, as David is saying, you know, the amount of management and growing knowledge that's required to do a highly diversified farm is very, very large. And then in addition to that, you have to be also an expert at customer service and culinary arts in terms of making sure people can cook these things. So I think that the challenges are quite formidable in terms of the knowledge and the diversity of the knowledge needed to run it. But I think generally, you know, I've been giving a lot of thought to policies that could support this, because the benefits that society gets from CSA is quite large. It's much beyond the fresh local produce, which is quite fantastic. The other benefits are really, you know, in our research we showed that the dollar amount in terms of gross sales per acre of CSAs is very, very high, which means that it's supporting a lot of workers. It's giving, that means a lot of jobs for communities, and they're high quality farm work jobs relative to a lot of California, where you have more year-round security of employment, which is super important for farm workers in our state, and generally higher salaries, higher benefits. So those benefits are to workers. There's also kind of the multifunctionality benefits in terms of what, you know, people call ecosystem services, with carbon sequestration, with all the compost that most CSAs or farmers are using, providing valuable climate service, right, in terms of mitigating climate change. There's all these hosts of benefits that CSAs provide, but unfortunately, society, we don't have a lot of policy mechanisms that support that. So we leave it up to individual consumers to say, oh, I'm willing to pay more for all these positive benefits. And that means that if we're letting people pay more, we're going to be relying on the people who have more money, and rather than kind of general policy support. So what I would like to see in California would be, you know, policies that support small scale and or diversified farmers who are doing this kind of work with all these multiple benefits.
Right. And we've all kind of talked about in some way, you know, going to grocery stores and how easy it is to get so many things, especially things that are not seasonal here in this area. I mean, what does all this say about maybe how difficult it can be to maintain a CSA and to get people to pay for it, even though there is some demand? What does all this say about, you know, the food system that we have set up in this country and the way that we kind of connect with our, you know, with agriculture?
Well, I could talk for 10 hours on this, on this subject. Yeah, it's really difficult. The free market's a very efficient system. It isn't a very kind one. Mm-hmm. We would all love to produce under socialism, but use the money we earn to purchase in the free market. To me, what we had, what does the most good for the most people is the free market. And so we have to figure out how to differentiate ourselves. If we can quantify the nutritional value, David, of what we produce, mm-hmm. and show that that is a vastly superior product nutritionally.
That's right.
It's going to take a lot more farmers to accomplish that.
I really agree with him. You know, the challenge of running and maintaining a business is not unique to farmers. In the American economic system, and I'm like Vernon, I believe in the free market, but you've got to be innovative, and the consumer and the whole marketplace is going to challenge you to be creative and keep up and be progressive in what you do. And it doesn't matter if you're in manufacturing or technology. It's about innovation and moving forward. And that is a challenge for farmers, because we tend to get focused on what we're growing and need to innovate in regard to how we interact with the community and how we package our product. And Vern said really well, and something I'm passionate about is, you know, the average plate of American food, I think the statistic is, travels 1,500 miles before you get to eat it. Well, for the, I don't want to say majority, but for a lot of produce items, that's got to be picked before it's biologically mature. And I've heard this a lot. I'm only 40, but I've heard this a lot from older Americans. Food doesn't taste like it used to. Well, that's a result of farming practices, true, but also a result of food industry changes, where you've got a more global food industry and a lot of transportation of food, and educating people on all of those issues and helping them to understand how to make better choices as a consumer, as a person in the kitchen, for your own health, and all of those things are really important too.
I guess I had one further thought, and it was really to agree on the nutrient density of food coming out of these systems and the importance of that research. So I'd love to be part of that work with either Vernon or David. But I wanted to kind of push back a little bit on the idea of the free market and the way that it operates in the U.S. because it, to me, we don't see a lot of elements of the free market system working that well here, in the sense that one is the support system for agriculture in the U.S. is highly skewed towards very big farms and towards conventional farms. And so that creates an incentive structure that's going to privilege both conventional farming and also larger scale and kind of farmers getting bigger. On the other hand, in terms of kind of the meat, the bloodline, right, of agriculture, a lot of it's fossil fuels in terms of conventional fertilizer, the use of tractors. Fossil fuels are vastly undervalued in terms of the actual costs that they impose on society now and in the future. If we were to pay the true cost of fossil fuel burning, it would be much more expensive. But instead, we're having future generations pay that cost. And so we're externalizing those negative environmental consequences and not paying the true cost of those food goods. And CSA farmers are internalizing a lot of those costs and having to compete against a system that's externalized those. That's not fair either. And it's not free. It just means we're not paying the true costs of fossil fuels. And then lastly, the concentration in the food system, the power of some of the biggest food companies is so big that they're able to kind of break free of the important kind of beneficial effects of competition and have oligopolies where they can get way more profit out of the food system than farmers do now. So if we had a system where there wasn't nearly as much power concentrated in the big food industry oligopolies and the retail oligopolies, then farmers could potentially get more money for their dollar overall. And then prices wouldn't be so low also for what farmers are receiving in terms of farm gate prices. So those are a few thoughts in terms of how the market's not working in a free market kind of way in the U.S. and the ways that we could use policy to make it work more efficiently and more fairly.
All right. Well, really interesting. I feel like we could keep talking about this for hours. But I want to thank you all, David Overmiller, Vernon Peterson, and Ryan Galt. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.
My privilege.
Thank you, Gary.
Custom made, sweeted. You want to know what sweeting is? You take what you like. Rush Hour 2.
Charlie Mystic.
RoboCop.
Excellent choice. And mix it with some other things you like and make a new thing.
What's happening to our hearts?
Your thing. It's putting you into the thing you like.
Start over. Sorry, cut.
And now for the weekend. It's time for Fresno's annual Swede Fest, where amateurs and sometimes expert filmmakers take their favorite movies and remake them with friends and family and lots of household props. Today I'm speaking with Rocky Rodriguez. He's one of the founders of Swede Fest. Welcome.
Hello. Hi.
So I hear Swede Fest and I think, oh, this must be a Scandinavian film festival. But that's not it, right?
It is not. No, that's a very common misconception because of the name of the type of films that we'll be showing.
So what's the connection to Sweden?
So in 2008, there was a movie directed by Michel Gondry called Be Kind, Rewind. And in the movie, these guys run a video store, an old school VHS store. They accidentally erase all the VHS tapes. And so they have a loyal following. And in order to kind of, you know, keep the people that come to the video store to rent movies to keep coming, they decide to, like, remake the movies themselves for, you know, the neighborhood. And because it takes them a little while to actually make them, once they come in and request, you know, a certain movie, their way of kind of explaining it is that these are, and they're Swedish versions of the film, and that's why they're a little off, and that's why they're kind of homemade. It's just that's the thing that came out, their idea to kind of explain it. So the term Sweded comes from the movie, so we kind of took that concept and kind of just ran with it.
So you started it with Brian Harley, who is the executive director of CMAC. But why did you start it?
So in 2008, there was I just kind of moved back into town, and I just like loved films, and there wasn't a film community here in Fresno, really, at least that people that were kind of collaborating and talking to each other yet, and that was the time of like blogs and stuff like that. So I had a blog at the time and talking about film, and I just saw Be Kind, Rewind. I was kind of inspired by that, and in the film they create these sweeted movies, and it kind of brings the community together. So I kind of took the idea, and I made a sweet video of Indiana Jones in the Temple of Doom. I'm sorry, Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I put it up on our blog and on the blog, and I was just like, here, Fresno, like, that I made this. See if you guys can do any better. Like, I know you guys, you know, I wanted to kind of see who, I know there's people out there that love film as much as I do. So I put it out there, and we got a, you know, pretty all right response. But then I was approached by William Raines from Corridor 2122 in downtown Fresno. He's like, you know what you should do is like turn this into a festival, and you can come do it at the art gallery as part of the art gallery. And I thought that was a great idea. So from that, we just kind of put something together in a few months, and we had our first Sweet Fest in downtown Fresno in 2008.
So you two are the first to do a Sweet Festival.
Yes.
But others are doing it now?
Yeah, so subsequently, as we've done our entries for Brian and I's entries for the festival, we've been lucky and gotten some national recognition over the time with some of our entries. And so a few years ago, we did a suite of trailer of the Avengers movie. So it got kind of picked up by a lot of the Hollywood people that actually worked on the film, and Hollywood Reporter did a story on it. NPR picked it up for its morning edition, did a story on it. So from there, we ended up getting a lot of interest from outside the area. So we have now satellite festivals in West Palm Beach in Florida. And we've had some as far as in Edinburgh, New England. So now there's one in Pittsburgh. So there's all these Sweet Fests that are popping up around the country and around the world.
So do you have the copyright on Sweet Festival?
No, we didn't really want to. We just kind of wanted to make something for people to kind of go out and do stuff. So for us, it wasn't like, you know, something we wanted to like monetize or anything. For us, we were just kind of hoping to spread the gospel of filmmaking for, you know, communities around that are very similar to Fresno.
And have you been to all of these Sweet Festivals?
No, we have not. We've never really gone to any of ones, but, you know, we're hoping that eventually we'll make our way to go to see what's going on all these different little festivals.
How many films have you sweeted?
So at the early on, Brian and I used to make our own suited films for the festival, just because we were barely getting started and there weren't that many entries and awareness wasn't out there. So we each made one for the festival. But then, like, as we started growing, we just started collaborating on our own, and we've created one, at least one for every festival.
So how long does it take you to put together a suite film?
So for us, we kind of try to take it to the next level. We try to recreate movie trailers shot for shot, and we try to get it as close as possible using, you know, cardboard. And so we're taking these big Hollywood films, multi-million-dollar, $100 million films, and trying to figure out how can we do this in my backyard using cardboard and stuff that we buy at the Dollar Tree. So we do take a lot of time to make it and to match it as close as possible. So it could take anywhere from, you know, we've done one as short as like maybe a month working on weekends and after work up to, you know, this one, we took it a little bit slower. This took us basically like 4 months, and we got a team of people that have just come together and, you know, collaborate and have fun and try to come up with these ideas of how do we replicate this, you know, $1 million shot in my backyard.
Wow. And I'm sure there are many entrants who don't spend as much time making films like you and Brian do. Do you accept all of them?
We do, as long as, so the thing with Sweet Fest is it's family friendly. It's a free event and it's family friendly. It's all ages. So as the two criteria that we have are that it's a family friendly film or video. I mean, we have people that have suited Pulp Fiction, R-rated films, but they've come up with creative ways to get around the violence and stuff like that. So that just adds to the humor of it. So as long as that meets the standards of being able to be shown at an all ages festival, then yeah, we accept all of them and we show all of them.
Would you say most of them are funny?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are, because it's coming up with, you know, it's the creative problem solving that people come up with of like, how do I translate this, you know, this scene or whatever into like something I can shoot in my living room or with my casting my mom and my dad in this film. So yeah, it's really great to see how people, the creative process kind of comes together of just like the problem solving of creating a film.
So Sweet Fest is going to run tonight at 7 p.m. at the Tower Theater. Tell us what kinds of films we'll be seeing.
So yeah, we have E.T., for instance, is one that we got this time. We have the Avengers Endgame. Superhero movies are big right now. So we have The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. We have Aroma Swede. So, you know, it's kind of like all across the board, and we have a lot of good ones coming in. And we also have some international entries, too. So a school reached out to us from London, and they got together, their video team got together and created three little films for us. And yeah, so it's all over the place. Yeah, it's good.
So since you started doing it, how has the festival evolved?
Well, we started in downtown Fresno. In our gallery, we had 30 people show up for the first one, and we thought that was a huge success. So eventually what we wanted to do is take it to a movie theater, and luckily through our sponsors that we've gotten in the last couple of years with Fres Yes and Fresno Filmworks, they've allowed us to be able to go to a big movie theater, and we're at the Classic, Tower Theater in Fresno. So in that instance, we've been able to kind of showcase these films at a real theater. So the filmmakers get to kind of participate in the process from the very beginning of, like, how do we plan this movie, to the very end of, like, you're going to your Hollywood premiere at a movie theater with a huge audience. So it was very important for us to get there. So the evolution of going from art gallery downtown Fresno to the Tower Theater with an audience of 500 people, it's been a crazy ride.
And for listeners who can't attend SweetFest, can they find the films online?
Yes, we will post them online at sweetfest.com after the event. And for our personal films that Brian and I have done for Dumb Drum, which is our production company, you can just go to dumbdrum.com and you can see all of our videos there.
Well, fantastic. Thanks so much, Rocky.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on your smartphone. The show is produced by our news team, Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein, and myself, Laura Satsui.
Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.